Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 10, Interview with Sarah Vanderwood. Hi, and welcome to the Sled Dog Podcast. This is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that stretches, stimulates, and strengthens you on the sport of ski-during.
Wow, S's. I see the Zach last time. The S for Sarah. That was pretty good.
Well...
yeah, what are those words?
Actually, again? The S's are for the ski during.
Oh, I thought it was for Sarah.
So we don't want to talk about that.
Oh, okay. So we don't want to talk.
S is for ski during.
Ski during. So, hey, we're going to shift gears this week a little bit. We've been talking to a lot of mushers. We've been talking to food folks, equipment folks. And now we're going to be talking about ski during. I got into ski during last year, probably because of default. We found ourselves in a situation where, because there were so many of us running in the family, that we didn't have enough dogs for me to actually run a 5-dog or 7-dog class. So instead, I strapped on some skis and I went at it. And it was great. I really had a ball with it and really kind of opened my eyes up to the whole world of, yeah, not just mushing, but also to ski-during. So if you have a smaller kennel or just a dog or two, you can go ahead and get into the sport of ski-during. And I loved it.
Yeah, it wasn't your first time cross-country skiing like that, though, right?
No, I've been cross-country skiing for pretty much since my youth, but it was definitely a new experience putting on some skis.
Definitely gave you a little exercise, didn't it?
Yes. Well, especially because I had a wonderful gentleman that we would run competitively against each other, and he always seemed to win. And I was working really hard, and he wasn't working very hard at all. So this year we've got to upgrade in our dogs, and I think I'm going to have a better chance of beating them this year.
Yeah. Tim just asked for one thing. Could I please just have fresh dogs? Because he gets the dogs that have already run, even though maybe some of them only ran a junior race, he's still getting tired dogs. So we're hoping to give him some fresh dogs when he has to go up against his competitor this year.
But the great news was, is last year I came in second in every single race I raced.
Yeah, you did really well, honey. I'm so proud of you.
Now, do I tell them that there was only two or three of us in every race? And
no, don't tell them.
Okay,
that.
There you go. So, okay, good. So today we've got an interview with Sarah Vanderwood.
We connected with Sarah in a couple different ways. I actually stumbled upon their website, which was formerly Run Dog Run, but right now for the winter season is Ski Dog Ski. So that's www.skidogski.com. And let's make sure you understand how to spell dog, because maybe some of you don't.
It's D-A-W-G. So it's Ski Dog, D-A-W-G, Ski. .com. And in the summertime, they do Run Dog Run, so they kind of flip it back and forth with a neat website. But either one will get you to the same place.
But we also connected with Sarah in a different way because her parents are the owners of Nooksack.
Nooksack Racing, yeah. We did an earlier interview. It was kind of surprising until we actually scheduled the interview with Sarah and we really started getting into her bio and finding out everything about her. All of a sudden, we realized that Sarah was related to the folks at Nooksack. So it's a small community, I guess. It's a smaller world than you think sometimes. But she is definitely a fantastic resource on ski-during.
Yes, great interview. If you want to know anything about ski-during, definitely continue listening to this interview. But also get to their website. You will learn a lot. We wanted just to highlight a couple things that are going on with that. There's actually, if you really want to learn about ski-during, or you want to have a little fun with it, the second annual Ski Dog Ski Camp is coming up December 28th through January 1st at Lake Placid, New York. And this is coming right off of the heels of their Run Dog Run Festival, which some of you might have heard about. It was a very large dry land race. And that was in October 27th to the 28th at Lake Placid, which I only bring that up, even though it's past, is perhaps because it went so well, there'll be another Run Dog Run Festival next year. So you might want to keep that on your calendars, those from the East Coast or those that want to do a real fun dry land race. They put that on as well. But the one coming up is for ski jurors. As you listen to the interview, you'll hear all about it. But we really want to go.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. Lake Placid, where the Olympics were held many years ago. I'm not sure how many years ago it was. I think Sarah talks about it a little bit. But they've got the facilities, and it's a wonderful location to actually have this kind of a race and or kind of events.
So it's, clinic.
So it's a whole clinic. And she tells all about it. But I think it was just a great shout-out to everybody out there that maybe if you've got just one or two dogs and you're thinking you want to be in the world of dog sledding or mushing, get into some races, or get into just being able to run your dogs a different way, strap on some skis or a scooter or a bike and head out. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity to kind of open the market for more people to get into the sport, and also just to remind everybody that their dog is not just a lay on the floor, that their dog really desires and strives to get out there and run. And it's a great way to help out.
Yeah, we don't want to forget about our mail. We did get a nice interview from Elizabeth from Australia.
Yes. Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much.
Actually,
and cheers back at you.
Cheers to you, Elizabeth.
Yes, it was wonderful to hear from you. So she's got a couple of Malamutes, and she loves them, and we just love to hear from you. So thank you so much, Elizabeth.
All right. Well, I think we're ready to hear a little more about ski-juring.
Yep. And don't forget, we got another tip from Dr. Tim right after Sarah's interview. This episode, Dr. Tim is going to be talking about breeding. And so it's going to be an interview that I learned a lot about, and it kind of meant something to us because right now, or at the time that Dr. Tim was sharing with us, is we had a pregnant little Siberian Husky. We call her little because she's really small. And so we were counting the days just when she was going to give birth, and so it was a good time for us to kind of learn all about the breeding. So thank you, Dr. Tim.
By the way, we are the proud owners for a short time of five little AKC Siberian puppies that will be hopefully finding a new home right after Christmas.
Yes, absolutely. So let's get to the interview.
Hi, well, let us begin. Today we are interviewing Sarah Vanderwood from Ski Dog Ski. That's www.skidogski.com. And she's going to talk to us a little bit today about ski-juring. So, Sarah, tell us a little bit about your website.
The website was actually launched in conjunction with myself and Jason Sperry of New York as a development tool to promote both dry land and ski-juring. We're both heavily involved with our respective clubs, me being from the Downey Sled Dog Club and Jason being from the Pennsylvania Sled Dog Club. And we're really looking to try to promote the single dog sports or the dual dog sports. So the canny cross, the bike joring, the ski joring, scooter, those types of disciplines. Because we really feel that that's where the growth in the sport of sled dog racing is going to come from. You don't need a lot of dogs to participate, so you don't have to the expense of large kennels, etc. So we came up with this idea last year of putting on a ski camp, a ski joring camp, actually, and we did it at Lake Placid, which was the home of the 1932 and the 1980 Winter Olympics. So it's a perfect venue for winter and fall outdoor recreation opportunities. And the camp went so well last year that we combined our efforts again to host the Run Dog Run Festival this past October, and then we're coming up in December on having our second annual Ski Dog Ski ski-joring camp.
Tell us a little bit about how you got into the whole sport to begin with, just so our listeners can hear about that.
I've actually been involved with the sport since I was 5 years old, so this will be my 32nd season, 31st season. And my parents had various interest in sled dog racing growing up. My dad had always listened to Sergeant Preston and thought that that was interesting, and my mom had a neighbor that had been in the military and worked with sled dogs. So we went to a race when I was about 5 years old and saw an actual race, and I told my parents I wanted a dog and got a sled dog for my fifth birthday and have been racing, competing, organizing in some fashion ever since.
And have you always lived in Maine?
I have not. I actually attended college at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and lived there for 5 years, the school years in Fairbanks and the summers in Denali.
Okay, and then you came back to Maine later on.
In 1995, I came back to Maine, and I had actually gone to college on a cross-country ski scholarship.
Wow.
And had raced sled dogs, you know, growing up, and had a coach in high school, my cross-country ski coach, actually used to hook his dog to himself and ski with him, which I thought was completely nuts. And then went to college and saw ski joring being done. And when I had left for college, I thought, you know, I'm never going to have to pick up dog manure again. I'm never going to have dog hair in my car, and thought life was going to be wonderful. And was in college, a couple of months, and realized that I didn't really quite know what to do with myself without a dog. And that summer, worked for the Dog Mushing Museum and actually did the Saco kart racing series for Bill Taylor, who's from Fairbanks, and just became more heavily involved in dogs and then started ski-joring at the recommendation of my boyfriend, who is now my husband. We ended up getting a puppy, and he really encouraged the both of us to start ski-joring, and my first race was actually the 1995 North American Championships in the ski-joring.
Wow.
And then we came back to Maine in 1995 and there was no ski-joring being done here. And my husband and I had taken a couple of clinics that were being offered by Alaska Feed and the Alaska Ski-Joring and Polk Association and really enjoyed what we got out of that and developed a similar program here on the East Coast for the first few years we were back and got ski-joring instituted as a sport here on the East Coast in conjunction with the sled dog races.
Great. So let me get this right. You went to college in Alaska hoping to never, you know, pick up manure or have dog hair in your car again. How you went to the home of the Iditarod?
Yeah, you know, but I thought, oh, well, I'm going to be in college, so I'm not really going to have those opportunities yet. Those opportunities seem to have found me.
Yeah.
So going across the country to Alaska for college, what drove you to do that versus just sticking to a local university?
Well, I had actually worked with a couple here that had lived in Maine for a year, Jim and Nancy Nolke, they both live in Alaska, and I had driven their team for them a couple of times while they were living here, and Nancy had worked in the admissions office at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I had taken a year off after high school, and she said, well, you know, why don't you think about going to school in Alaska?
Wow.
So I thought about it and applied, and they were actually moving back to Alaska at that time, and applied and got in, and then I was offered a cross-country running and skiing scholarship. So
that's wonderful.
With a cross-country running and skiing scholarship that I wouldn't possibly have time for dogs, but I found the time.
You always do. Isn't it amazing? And
yeah.
How did your mom and dad react when you started getting back into the sport? Were they excited, or were they, oh, boy?
No, they were actually excited. They, you know, thought that it was great that I was, you know, still interested in it. And then when Mark and I moved back, my parents were pretty much had made the decision to get out of it, that they were going to be retiring from the dog end of it. And when we came back, I said, no, I'm not really ready to get rid of the dogs. And we took it easy for the first couple of years with running what the dogs that were getting older in their kennel and ran them. And then after a couple of years, I decided that we, you know, needed some new breeding. And so we bought a litter of puppies. And then it just kind of snowballed from there.
Absolutely.
As it always does.
Yeah.
Now, when you bought your puppies and as you got into this, is as competitive? Or is it, I guess, the breeding and the psychology and the physiology of all the dogs, is it just as intense as some of the big sled races, or is it more of a relaxed community?
Well, I think you can find it on, I think there's both ends of the spectrum. There's certainly people that are out there doing it with their black labs or their standard poodles or whatever type of dog they may have, utilizing the house dog that they already have that they're trying to, you know, they're both trying to get some exercise. Then you can go to the other end of the spectrum where there's dogs that are being bred specifically for the Nordic style racing, the ski joring and the polka. Those dogs are predominantly coming from Scandinavia. Myself, I have imported a few dogs of that specific breeding here to the United States and have supplied many of the East Coast skiers with that breeding. And there's also Jason Sperry, who I mentioned earlier. He and his wife have also imported some of the Nordic style breeding from Czech Republic, which goes back to the Scandinavian breeding.
That's fantastic. So there's a lot to this if you really want to make a lot out of it, similar to regular sled racing.
Absolutely, yes.
That is great. Well, let's take a shift a little bit. Tell me a little bit about the races themselves and the events, I should say. Tell us about what those are all about.
Most of the events we have here on the East Coast are events that are specific. They're ski-joring races that are in conjunction with the sled dog races. There's not very many races that are standalone ski-joring races. There have been a couple here and there, but predominantly they are in conjunction with the sled dog races. When the sport first started here, we were pretty much running the Downey Sled Dog Club offers just the one and two dog ski joring. There are other clubs in the East that also offer three dog ski joring, but Down East does not. When we first started, we were running on the four dog trail, which would be anywhere between 3 and 5 miles generally. 2-day event, fastest combined time from the 2 days wins, just like a regular sled dog race. And then we had people, including myself, who were looking towards wanting to compete at a higher level. And at the IFSS, the International Federation of Sled Dog Sports, at their world championships, which are generally held every 2 years, the races for the ski joring were much longer. In Fairbanks in 2001, which was the first race that world championship that offered ski joring only, not the polka, but the ski joring, the one dog was 9 miles and the two dog was 14 miles. So in preparation for that, the people that were interested in competing at a higher level started pushing for longer races for the ski joring here in the East. So many of the races, particularly the Down East races now, do offer trail like anywhere between a 5 and a 7 mile trail. So generally whatever the six dog would race for mileage is the same mileage that we'll do in the ski joring now, both one and two dog, which brings us into better alignment with what they're doing at the international level.
That is so interesting. I think it's such a wonderful opportunity for folks that only have, you know, a few dogs that just obviously they're passionate about it, but maybe they can't keep a big kennel for 6 or 8, 10, 12 dog run. I think it's wonderful. Yes. What is the receptiveness of the community and also of the race itself? It sounds like you've really made a lot out of this. Has it just been totally embraced? Are people just loving it?
When we first got it instituted, it was certainly something that some of the sled dog people were skeptical about, thinking that, you know, it was going to take up too much time in the day, that we already had enough going on, you know, there were enough classes. But in general, I think people now, it's just part of the day. It's, you know, the ski joring goes out and, you know, we compete just like any of the sled classes do. And I think it's very much embraced now. There certainly have been people that have come into the sport of ski joring that have moved into other classes, and then are also people that were getting ready to retire from the sled classes who have continued to ski jore. So I think it's brought new people into the sport, and it's allowed other people to stay in the sport longer that didn't want to maintain those larger kennels. They were able to cut back drastically on their number of dogs, but still stay very involved in the sport.
So with that in mind, obviously, you know, anything from a inexpensive old pair of cross-country skis to some of the new high-tech equipment, what do you recommend or what do you tell people as they're starting to get into ski joring?
If people are just starting to get into it, I don't recommend that they go out and spend a lot of money on new equipment. I always tell people to try and get like end of season deals at ski shops or to go. Many communities, particularly in the northern tier states, have either at the high school or the college level, they'll have a community ski swap where you take your skis in, a percentage of the money goes to support local ski programs, and then you get a percentage of the sale of the equipment. So you can find a lot of great equipment at events like that, or touring centers that may have demo equipment that was used throughout the winter that they're selling off, or they're just upgrading equipment and getting rid of some of their older stuff. Those are all really great places to be able to buy equipment. I don't recommend that somebody go out and spend $1,000, which you can easily spend on new skating equipment, $1,000 plus, because what happens if you get involved in it and you decide you don't like it or the dog decides that they don't like it? Well, then you shouldn't have to have all this investment to decide that you didn't really like it. I don't know very many people that have bought equipment that haven't liked it, but there is, you know, it does happen. And then once you've been in it a little while and you really enjoy it, your dog is enjoying it, then you can decide where you want to go. Do you want to race? If you want to race competitively, then you're going to have to upgrade as your skiing abilities improve and your competitive desire improves, then you're probably looking at needing to spend some more money to buy more competitive equipment. If you just want to do the recreational thing and you just, you know, want to go bumming around in the backcountry, well, then you would get equipment that would be specific to those types of needs. You know, maybe something, a fish scale as opposed to waxable skis, or backcountry skis as opposed to cross-country skis. It all depends on what it is exactly you want to do, but you don't really know what it is you want to do until you have the opportunity to try it for a season and say, wow, I really like this, I want to be competitive, or, you know, I'm not so interested in being competitive, I just want to go out on a Saturday afternoon in the woods with my dog. So you really need to get the equipment that's going to allow you to participate at the level that you want to participate at.
And Sarah, are you noticing that most of the skis these days, I mean, you go from the backcountry, and then is the other side of that, the very competitive side, is that a skating ski? So if somebody walks into a store and they say, I'm looking for ski gearing, I think most of the people will say, what are you talking about? So you really should ask for a skating type cross-country ski?
The skating motion lends itself much better to competitive ski joring than does diagonal or classical, what people traditionally think of as being cross-country skiing. It's just the movement is just much better with the skating. The rhythm that you're able to maintain while running your dog is, the skating is more conducive to that than the classical would be. So if you're looking to be competitive and you wanted to race, you would most likely be asking for skating skis.
That is fantastic.
So the fish scales that are like on the bottom of the skis, those are actually kind of slowing you down.
Correct.
Which might be a good thing.
Well, yes. And if you're somebody that doesn't like to wax and you want your skis to be able to work in, you know, all conditions or whatever, and you're not interested in having to, you know, really take care of your skis and wax them, then yes, that's what you would want. But those are not going to be competitive skis.
Right, absolutely. The wintertime is a great time, obviously, to be in the woods or to be in the race circuit and doing the different things. But tell us, how do you train your dogs in the summer to, you know, get them ready? Obviously, a lot of people don't have 8 or 10 dogs in a big cart. So what's the best way to train a ski-during dog?
If your dog is good off-leash and you can take them somewhere and just allow them to run through the woods, free running is great conditioning. In fact, most of your competitive ski jurors in the European countries, particularly the Scandinavian countries, I would say probably 75% of their conditioning is done with free running. And they just do harness work, you know, 1 or 2 times a week. And I know very competitive polka and ski jurors, mushers, that have used swimming as a technique to keep their dogs in shape in the summer. And they either swim or boat with their dogs while their dogs swim, which is particularly with the polka, where you need a lot of power in the front end of the dog. A lot of power is derived from the chest of the dog. The swimming is really good for that. It can easily over-muscle a dog. Say you had, there's kind of a fine balance there where if you're at that level, you would know, you know, when to back off or when to increase that muscle in the front end. But those are certainly techniques that can be used in the summer. Generally, we don't do too much pulling of any sort in the summer unless it's just really targeted pull training. We usually don't start pull training until later in the summer or early fall when the temperatures are starting to cool down and we're not worried about overheating the dogs. And then you can start with bike joring or scootering or canicross. Any of those types of disciplines would be good training for ski joring.
And Sarah, back up just for our audience. Would you define canicross?
Canicross is running with your dog. It's simply a belt around your waist with a bungeed line to a dog's harness, very similar to the same type of setup that you would use for ski joring, and you're just running with your dog. Obviously, that's a human-limiting activity because the human is most likely going to be the slower part of that team. But it certainly allows you to get out with your dog. It's good for leader training because it's you're able to instantaneously correct a dog if it's doing something that it should not be doing, whether, you know, you can practice your on-by, your straight ahead, your commands, all of that kind of stuff. bike drawing would be with the person on a mountain bike and the dog running out in front, and then scooter would be somebody on a scooter with the dog out in front.
Now, scootering is kind of getting popular these days. I just noticed the sites and the companies are starting to produce some more. Mm-hmm. Has it always been around, or is it relatively new?
You know, there's been people, you know, I can remember a guy back when I was a kid that did it. I also knew somebody that ran his dogs while he stood on a skateboard. So, I mean, there's probably been manifestations of it all along, but as more of an organized activity, we are seeing a lot more of it now. The scooter class, we actually had at the Run Dog Run Festival in Lake Placid. The scooter class actually was the most competitive of the classes that we offered. The two-dog scooter. There's, at the world level, they offer a one- and a two-dog scootering class. And many of your ski jurors feel that the scooter is the closest dry land discipline to ski jurring, because with the bike jurring, you have the mechanical advantage of being able to really stay in contact with your dog if you're a really, really great cyclist. Whereas the scooter, the kicking motion of the driver plus the actual pulling that the dogs have to do, a lot of people say that that's the dry land equivalent of ski joring.
Now, just let's run back for a second. You mentioned a little bit about commands. Are we also Jiha training these dogs normally, or do people just do whatever they do?
I think the people that come from a sled dog background are certainly using the Jiha commands, or any person that may be getting a sled dog that has come out of the mushing world is using those commands. I'm sure that there's people out there that have absolutely no connection to the sled dog world and may be using their own commands.
Right, but commands are definitely necessary in the ski jour world.
Yeah, very much so.
Sarah, why don't you tell us a little bit about the camp coming up?
The camp is actually, like I said, it's going to be the second annual Ski Dog Ski Camp, and it's hosted by the Downey Sled Dog Club and the Pennsylvania Sled Dog Club. And it's a Mushing USA event. We're hoping that it's going to, what our original intention was when we developed the camp was that it would kind of become the national training camp. Several of the Scandinavian countries actually have the people that are on their national Nordic-style teams, their polka and ski-joring teams, they're required to go to a camp, usually in December, November or December is when they have them. And it's everything from, you know, waxing and nutrition to, you know, commands and preparing your dog. And so that's kind of what we modeled it after. And last year we actually had a Scandinavian polka musher that came over and was there for the camp, and that was sponsored by both the Norwegian and the Swedish federations. Fortunately, this year we're not going to have that, but I think we can really build on what she did last year. And the camp is open to all people of all abilities, from beginners to you know, if you want to consider yourself an expert or advanced. And for both canines and humans, whatever your ability level is, this camp is open to it. We have a nightly lecture each of the nights. This year, the first lecture will be on waxing. The second one will be on skating technique, and will be the guest lecturer will be a former Olympian who skied on the World Cup circuit as well, who is from the Lake Placid area. And then the third night, it will be on canine conditioning. And then in the mornings of the camp, so Saturday, Sunday, Monday mornings from 8 to 11, we offer race-specific or canine conditioning stuff. So it'll be ski-joring specific. So whether that'll be dog training or conditioning or any of the things that actually have to do with ski-joring. And then in the afternoons of each day from 1 to 4 will be human training. So it'll be improving skating techniques. So whether you're a beginner, the coaches will be divided into groups of varying ability, or of that'll be specific to a certain ability. So we'll have our beginners and intermediate and advanced. So you'll work on things specific to your ability level. And on Saturday afternoon, we'll actually have a two-hour clinic that will be open to the public. So the public from the Lake Placid area or from wherever people want to come from, it will be an opportunity for them to try ski joring with trained ski-joring dogs.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Last year we had about 50 people that participated in that component, and we had 20 that participated in the camp. And we did have some people last year that were at the camp that were at the clinic last year that have shown interest in coming back for the camp this year. And we really felt that the clinic is important because it's really a development tool. It allows people to come in and say, wow, I can do this. I've got a dog that, you know, we actually had somebody that showed up with a Labradoodle last year and asked if they could try it. And we gave them the equipment that they needed and gave them some basic instruction, and the dog did great.
That's fantastic. Now, you know, we have a lot of listeners literally around the world. We have some folks from the UK. We've got a lot of people in Alaska, all over the place. If people obviously can't come to the event there, and boy, it'd be nice to head up there, wouldn't it? But if they can't make it there, what would you suggest for them to, you know, to get into this as much as they can? And what's the best way for people to learn other than being able to come to a camp?
Well, I know that there's some organizations throughout Alaska, they do similar, you know, maybe not a camp, but I know that they do clinics and they do fun days where you can go. I know several of the Alaskan ski-joring organizations do that, where they have days where you can go and, you know, they have potlucks where club members bring stuff and new people can go and try it out. And I'm not positive, but I'm thinking that maybe there's a similar program in Minnesota where the Minnesota ski jurors do something like that, although I'm not positive. There are certainly lots of websites out there, resources. The Ski Dog Ski website is a great resource because it kind of takes you through. We have a section on equipment for both humans and dogs. We have basic conditioning of your animal and then ski-specific type stuff on there. And we launched the site in July, so we're still working on updating it and putting new stuff up there. It's definitely a work in progress, but as people tell us what they think they're, you know, questions that they may have or needs that are unmet by the website, we're trying to answer that by putting new information up there. Or getting in, you know, if you don't know of any ski-joring specific things, you could certainly contact a sled dog club. People could contact sled dog clubs, and they generally would be able to give information on someone in their club or someone in one state over or something that might have some information to be able to help get somebody started.
Yeah, the Ski Dog Ski webpage I love. I mean, you've got so many just quick little helpful tips that even if you read it over before you walked into an equipment purchase, it would be so much helpful, you know. So
is there one book that you think would help as well? Or
there's actually a couple books on the market. Ski Jour with Your Dog was written by Carol Kaner and Mary Heredo, and that was really the first book that was out. It's out of print. It's my understanding that it's out of print now, but if someone could get their hands on that, that's a great resource. And then Ski Spot Run is also a really good resource.
Okay, that's great.
Sarah, we've asked you a lot of questions, and we're, you know, obviously we're being a little selfish because I'm trying to learn as much as I can so I can win some races this year. But is there anything else that you'd like to talk about?
My focus the last few years has really been on development and just really trying to get new people involved in the sport. I mean, you hear all the time that, you know, if your dog's fat, you're not getting enough exercise, which I think is a very true statement. There's lots of people out there that have dogs that, you know, are certainly capable and I'm sure would be willing if trained and conditioned properly to do this. And I think it's a great way for people to be able to get out there with their animal. And particularly there have certainly been animal rights cases that have, you know, there's always an animal rights element to. I mean, here in Maine we have different organizations that are, you know, targeting different working dog groups, whether it be hunting or sled dog racing or what have you. And for every person that has a dog that is athletic, that can go out and run with them, it's one more person that says, you know, my dog really loves to do this. This isn't something that I'm making it do. It's something that it really wants to do. And it's one more person that understands, and then every person that knows that person says, you know, That's not bad. I've got a friend that, you know, runs with their dog or bikes with their dog, and their dog just absolutely loves it. So I think the more people that we can have involved in this, the more understanding there will be of our sport, and hopefully make our sport look better in the eyes of some that don't see it as a good thing.
You know, it's almost backwards, isn't it? It's amazing when you hear people talk about, you know, not nice to the dogs when you're running them on a dog sled or something, but it's just the opposite. It's to take those dogs and not run them on a sled or behind, you know, in front of a bike or ski during. That's when you don't love the dog, because they really do love it so much.
I've got a dog that's 12 years old. She came from a North American for a Ronde team. She's an incredible dog. She certainly, has lost her top end speed in the last few years and isn't able to run with the race team anymore. But every couple of runs, we'll take her out with a couple of older dogs and some of the younger puppies. And, you know, if she doesn't get to go out, she sits out in the kennel and she just howls. And it's such a mournful, it makes you feel horrible because you know how badly she wants to run. This is what she knows. This is what she enjoys doing. And it's heartbreaking when you don't run her.
Yeah.
You know, and if more people could see that, you know, and then I have another dog that is just, he's nuts. He's 75 pounds and he just yanks your arm off trying to handle him once he's put in harness. And it's just, you know, I had somebody say to me one time, you know, oh yeah, you know, you're just beating that dog to make him run. And they were joking when they said it. You know, and I said, yeah, with the arm he just yanked out of the socket because he's so excited to go that he's very, very difficult to handle. And that's what people need to see, is it's nothing that I've done except allowed him to do what he wants to do that has created this attitude in him.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the best part about it. I think it's just such a wonderful sport, and I love the fact that it's open to anybody. With your Labradoodle or whatever you have, you know, you can get into the sport until you get to that point where you really want to get going with speed or being professional with it. So it's fantastic.
At the Run Dog Run Festival that we had about half, we had 58 participants, and about half of the participants were people that were brand new to the sport that had never done any type of sled dog related or dog powered discipline before. And I think we got some converts. We had, you know, the featured event of the festival was the Canicross, because that's the one that I think people can most identify with. There's lots of these events out there that generally they're fundraisers for humane societies or shelters where, you know, there's Strut Your Mutts or Canine Fun Run or whatever other cutesy names are given to these events. But there's, as we're finding, there's tens, maybe hundreds of them out there. And those are the people that we're trying to bring in, is the people that, you know, are already doing this type of thing with their dog but don't really know what it is they're doing with them, and trying to really bring them into the sport. And we did have, like I said, about 27 new participants that were brand new that had never done this type of thing before. And a couple of them have already shown interest in coming to the ski joring camp because, you know, they had such a great time bike joring or running with their dog that they, you know, really think that ski joring is the next thing that they really want to do with their dog.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Well, you got any funny stories or, like, amazing stories in the sport of ski joring, or are they not ended up being good ones?
I had a trip to Scandinavia a few years ago. I had always, in 1993, the World Championships was being held in Fairbanks, the International Federation of Sled Dog Sports World Championships. And at that time, they just had the polka, which was, it's ski drawing, but between the skier and the dog is this weighted sled called the polk. And the dogs, if you run multiple dogs, the dogs are single file in shafts, or what the Norwegians call drogs, which is these metal tubes that go down the sides of the dogs that keep them single file, and then those are attached to the polk, and it keeps the polk from being able to run over the dogs on the downhills. So I had seen this in 1993, and just thought that was just amazing. The athleticism of the dogs and the skiers was just incredible to me. And in 2001, I actually competed in the World Championships in Fairbanks. And in 2000, that was in February and March of 2001. In October of 2001, IFSS brought over Robert Carell, who had been the short polka and the one-dog ski-joring champion at the 2001 World Championships, and brought him to Maine for a seminar that we were having. And he invited, after his stay here, he invited me to go to Scandinavia to train with him and some of the Norwegian team. So I did that, which was just a fantastic experience. but we had gone, Robert and myself and this other girl who was on the Norwegian team had gone to this ski area in Hamar, and it was night, it was dark out, and the fog was so unbelievably thick that you couldn't see 2 feet in front of you.
Holy
the headlamps were doing absolutely nothing because it was just as if they were bouncing off a wall. I mean, you couldn't see anything. So the three of us are skiing, and we've got, I guess it was four dogs running loose around us, one of which was a seven-month-old puppy. And
wow.
Norway is very, very, very hilly. And Robert had equipped me with this, all I could think was it was like this coal miner's helmet. It had this big battery pack on the front and this harness, and the thing weighed like 10 pounds and this big, huge light off the front, which, as I said, was doing absolutely nothing. But you couldn't see anything. I mean, I can't stress that it was like being in a cave almost, because you just had no concept of where you were or what you were doing. And Henrietta and Robert both knew these trails very, very well. They knew exactly where they were at all times. I, of course, did not. And I'm just skiing along and can't tell if it's a hill, if I'm going uphill or downhill, except when I'm on it, and it was just dogs running across the top of my skis. And then Robert says, oh, okay, well, now we have to hook the dogs to ourselves, because, like I said, they do a lot of free running with their dogs. So as they're skiing, their dogs are just running all over the place and coming back to them and running up ahead, and just, you know, this is how they get conditioned. So Robert's training technique is he allows them to run, to free run like this while he's skiing for, you know, 20 minutes or so. And then he hooks them to himself for 10 minutes. So then we hook the dogs to ourselves for this 10 minutes, and it was just out of control. I have no idea how I'm still alive, because I couldn't see anything. I mean, I went up this hill, and then all of a sudden I get to the top of this hill, and it just felt like the world had fallen out from underneath me, because I'm just being pulled along at probably 23 miles an hour by these supercharged Norwegian dogs.
Oh, my goodness.
And have no idea where I am or what I'm doing, and it just feels like the world is falling out from underneath me.
And when the hill's going to stop.
Yeah, I just hoped that the dogs knew where they were going, and that, you know, there was nothing in the middle of the trail, because I couldn't see a thing. So that was exciting. And
they can't create those rides at Disney World. That's just impossible.
It's absolutely not, and that's exactly what it was. It was, you know, exhilarating and scary, and so that was...
Wow, and it's awesome you didn't meet a tree at all.
I know.
Or a cliff, or a bear. Well, I don't know.
Well, they were maintained cross-country ski trails, so, you know, you pretty much knew that none of, you know, you weren't going to fall off the side of a cliff, but, you know, who knows? Maybe if the dog had decided at the last minute to take a wrong turn.
Oh, that is so scary. Well, and I can imagine, just being in that unique place, unique dogs, unique everything, and I would have loved to see your face like the next day. You probably would have been like, oh, this is no big deal, or it's, you put me through that? You know, it would have been one of the two reactions, you know, just absolutely crazy.
Well, then my husband came over after a few days. I was there for 2 weeks. He came over for 4 days at the end, and by then the snow, they had gotten a lot of rain, and the snow was non-existent in a lot of places, so we had to drive one day to find snow, and we found a place that only had barely enough snow cover to even be able to ski on. We took our rock skis, and as the dogs were running, they were actually kicking rocks up from underneath. But
The
amazing thing is there's just trails, maintained trails everywhere in Norway. You just drive out onto the ends of these roads, and there's this beautifully groomed cross-country ski trail. So we found this one place, and Robert gave my husband two dogs and said, okay, you run them for 10 minutes, and then you let them go. So Mark said, okay. So he takes off, and it's all downhill. I'm not kidding. It was downhill for 10 minutes, a mountainside on one side and a cliff on the other.
Oh.
And he gets to the bottom of basically this long ravine, and the 10 minutes is up. And then it's uphill in the trail continues uphill. So
did they not like Mark?
Well, that's what Mark kept saying, is that Robert was trying to kill him.
Yeah. Or did he think he needed to lose some weight, I guess? I don't know. That's
we'll
hilarious.
We'll see what these Americans
I think it was
do.
Just the American initiation.
Yeah, the hazing. We'll go on trail five. Yes.
I think I'd be heading back to the car.
That is hilarious. Well, Sarah, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, and thank you for taking your time out of your busy day. We've learned a ton, and I hope our listeners just really enjoy listening to not only the stories, but all the education and information on Ski-Jurin.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
And the listeners will also get to, in our show notes, we'll find out about your Ski-Jurin ski camp from December 28th to January 1st. And also, obviously, there'll be a link to your website, Ski Dawg Ski.
And that's DAWG.
Yes.
Correct.
That's good. Well, fantastic. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sarah. That was wonderful. And I hope everybody really enjoyed that. So I'll remind you just to get out to her website at www.skidawgski, and that's DAWG, Ski Dawg Ski, and strap on some skis this winter and get out there and enjoy the outdoors. So let's get on to Dr. Tim's quick vet tips, and here we go. Dr. Tim, let's talk about breeding today.
Sounds good to me. Breeding's always a interesting topic when you get into a group of mushers as to what people look at as to how they choose the dogs to breed and what their plan is. You know, definitely don't do a ramshackle, let's breed a lot of dogs, have a lot of dogs type thing, because then you're stuck with a bunch of animals and they may not have a purpose in life as to what to do. When we plan out our breeding program, we're trying to choose dogs that seem to be the most or most successful or most like what we want to have in our long-term goal. You know, what kind of dog do we want to see as a general rule in our kennel? So when we try to pick that out, either one, we're going to pick out a dog we have in our kennel that we think is top-notch, and then possibly take it to another top-notch dog out of our kennel, or maybe two within our kennel. Depending on what you're trying to achieve, if you're trying to ascend the ranks of racing world, there's a lot of dogs out there that have been selected from over a number of generations that can bring some great genetics into your dog pool right off the bat versus having to do it yourself. So I'm a big advocate of trying to choose some good males out there that we can bring to a female in our kennel and then bring some good genes in that way with some sort of a logical idea behind it. It doesn't mean you can't have breedings in your own yard and make them successful, but there might be an easier way to try to do that. The other thing to try to consider is if you ever sat down and figured out the cost of taking a litter of puppies to fruition versus buying a dog, it's probably less expensive to actually go out and buy a dog in many instances than raise the puppies from ground up. I just like to raise puppies up from ground up because then we can really instill some habits that we like to see in them and then take it from there. If we choose to go outside our kennel and bring some genes in to you know, upgrade our kennel more or less or get some different traits, you know, do that periodically. Some kennels go whole hog in that and have 5 litters a year, which to me is way overboard, and others might do a kennel or a litter every other year or every third year. But puppies are a big undertaking. They're a lot of work. So when we look at a breeding program, you know, have an idea of what you're trying to go for, you know, what kind of racing you want to do, what kind of dog you want to look at. Find a kennel that's been successful in that. See if how they raise their dogs and what they do is ethically considerable in your mind, you know, ethically reasonable, and then bring that, you know, that gene pool into your dog yard by a breeding. So if you can do that, I'm all for it. Again, down the road, if you decide to change your mind and get out of it, you're going to have a lot of dogs. So have a game plan in mind of what you're going to do with these dogs. Now, as to the actual breeding itself, if you're looking at trying to put dogs together, dogs come into heat twice a year. Spring and fall is a general rule. Females will usually start to bleed for about 3 weeks, and after about 9 days from initial blood that you'll see is when they're going to start to become receptive to a male. We usually then introduce the male to them every other day for 3 successful breedings if we can, and that should maximize your puppies that way. Every female is a little bit different with when they're going to accept that male, and might be a little bit more tricky than you think, and other ones are much more gung-ho. So when you look at that pairing, start about day 9 after you see first sign of estrus with that female, and then put those guys together every second day for about 3 breedings, and hopefully you'll get a big litter that way. Yeah, after you do that breeding, we're looking at about 63 days until they give birth. I usually count days one by one on the calendar from the last breeding, and then you're going to have your most accurate day of when those puppies are due. But give or take a couple days, I've had puppies that are born at 56 days. I've had puppies that were born at 65 days. So there might be a little give and take that way with your numbers. But 63 is going to be your average from the last day of breeding.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Why, certainly, certainly.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tim, for the interview. It's always great to hear from you and to get some quick tips, and we appreciate you taking your time out to share your knowledge and your experience with everybody in the industry. Don't forget, if you happen to be buying Christmas presents this year or any kind of presents for folks and you need some place to go, don't forget to go to Amazon.com.
Through our website. So you got to go to www.sleddogpodcast.com, then click on the Amazon site. You'll get connected right there to Amazon, and they'll give us a wee bit of a kickback.
Yeah, it's not a lot. I think we've made $1.20. So
I know, so. We're rolling.
But anyways, it does, every little bit helps to pay for the bandwidth, so maybe we can spread that link around everybody else. And of course, we're also looking for sponsors. So if anybody knows anybody that would like to sponsor the show, just let us know. And or if you're an equipment manufacturer, we've got some requests for trying out some different equipment and doing a little tech piece on the show. So if there's anything that you can think of, let us know. Other than that, have a great day.
Yep, and you can contact us at any time.
Oh,
we'd love
yeah.
to hear from you.
We never kind of tell you that. That's at sleddog at vbs20.com. That's vbs20.com. So again, just leave us an email, or you can go to the website, and in the upper right-hand corner it says mail to sleddogpodcast.com and get to us that way. So until next time, thank you so much, and
be blessed.